Welcome to the Portland Christian Center podcast. This week, our senior pastor, Ray Noah, continues our series, The Gospel of John. His sermon is based out of John chapter 1 and is titled Meeting God Face to Face. Now here's Pastor Ray.
We're in a series in the Gospel of John, and this entire month so far, we've been in John chapter 1. And you're going, okay, if I do the math, that means we're going to be in the Gospel of John until, like, Jesus comes back. Well, not necessarily. We're taking a lot more time in this first chapter, which is known as the prologue, and there's a lot of information. I get that. A lot of kind of heavy stuff, some theology and philosophy, and it really lays the foundation for where John is going to go, and we're going to get to that, and the pace kind of picks up in some of the action-oriented things that Jesus was involved in and the way he taught and all those kind of things. But and I expected today to move on to chapter 2. I really thought we would, but in reviewing chapter 1, just to check in my heart that we had covered all the things that the Holy Spirit wanted us to cover as a body, I just got stuck here. I got stuck in this particular section, and I couldn't move on, so guess what? You get to be stuck in it with me this morning. I found some more gold nuggets here. And we got to mine those gold nuggets out of them thar hills. So we're going to be here just this week only, and I really think that next week we'll move on. Now, I want to just let you know, I do not want to get bogged down in this, in spite of what it might seem like so far. I don't want to get too bogged down in the Gospel of John, because I think that would actually impede our journey into deeper intimacy with Jesus. If we get a wrong focus, if this becomes kind of a heady, intellectual, kind of theological-laden thing, that we could lose the right focus. And the focus here, as we've said before, is walking in this year, especially, we're going to focus on this, walking in closer, more knowledgeable, deeper intimacy with Jesus, because out of that will come everything else we really want and need in life. So I don't want to jinx that at all. But this first chapter is so full of what is called Christology and soteriology. You're going, you just said you don't want to get bogged down. Well, that simply is, Christology is our doctrine of Jesus Christ, and soteriology is our theology of salvation. Two very critical doctrines that we have to have, we have to grasp and embrace and absorb in our lives if we're going to have, as a church and you as an individual, if we're going to have a sound faith. But not only a sound faith, if you're going to grow in your intimacy with Jesus, you have to have knowledge. And so this is essential to that. By the way, when we plant churches around the world, and particularly in Africa where it's growing so rapidly, And we've been in previously unreached areas, and pagans, if you will, people that have no knowledge of God, are coming into the church by the thousands, but they're coming in out of paganism, out of witchcraft, out of devil worship, out of this kind of mixed Christianity with some other local religions, and we know that the danger is that they might bring into the church with them, because it's growing so rapidly, they bring in their previous spiritual customs and mix that in with their Christianity. And that's what we call syncretism. And that's happened throughout the history of the church. The faster the church grows, the more danger for syncretism to exist. And in fact, much of the New Testament letters was written to combat that. And the early church fathers wrote volumes on that, because that is the drift. If we're not careful, that will happen. And so to have a sound faith plus a more intimate walk with Jesus, we have to get these doctrines down. So having said that, I'm willing to risk a bit of a slower start in this in order to plumb the depths of this passage a little bit more. So would you bear with me as we unpack this section verse by verse, because it's going to give us an even closer glimpse of God, face to face, as it were, through Jesus. And remember, that was Paul's purpose in writing the Gospel of John. Remember, he's writing about 50 years after Jesus, after he walked with Jesus, his life and his death and his resurrection. About 50 years later, John has moved from Jerusalem all the way north into Asia Minor to Ephesus. It's a Greek city. It's a Gentile city. And he's now beginning to lead the Greeks to faith in Christ. And so he's wanting to help them to discover who God is through Jesus. And so he's got to find ways and words and ideas that will connect them, because they have not had any kind of previous experience with a God who is real, who is personal, who is singular, not many gods, but a singular God who is loving, a personal, singular, loving God. They don't know that. And so John has to find a way to be able to do that. That's his purpose. And so that's really what the Gospel of John, keep that in mind, is all about. So in chapters 2, John chapters 2 through 21, the second chapter on to the end, John is showing them, he's proving to them that Jesus is that God. We're heading into that next week. It's going to be fun. But in chapter 1, he's showing them through Jesus who God is. So John 2 through 21, Jesus is God. Jesus is God. Chapter 1, he's saying, look, if you want to know God, you're going to see him. This God that you think is not knowable, who's distant, who's multiple, you're going to see this singular, loving, personal God through Jesus Christ. So we're going to unpack verses 10 through 18 because it contains some vital, vital, vital truth. So let's begin with verse 10. Verse 10, it says, he was in the world. Stop. He was in the world. That's just a phrase, I know, but just stop there. This phrase, oh my goodness, this deserves a series of sermons. You're going, oh, please do not do that to us. I'm not. It deserves a sermon, an entire sermon. I'm not going to do that, but I do want to just talk about that for a moment, because what Paul is talking about here is that even before he was born as Jesus, the divine word, the eternal word, was active in the world. He was in the world. He was in the world as the creative power, as the reasoning mind that is the guiding force of God. Now, specifically, he had introduced himself, he had revealed himself to Israel through the Mosaic Law. We call that revealed theology, but John has something else in mind as he's opening this particular section. He has something else in mind. He's referring to what we would call natural theology. I don't know that he had that designation, but in essence, that's what John is heading into here. Natural theology, that is knowing God through the created order. Can you know God? Can you fully know God through the created order? Well, John says, yeah, there's evidence. There's evidence. The fact is that evidence of God is plainly seen in that the world is orderly, that man is a reasoning being or has powers of reason, and that human history follows a pattern. There's evidence of God in that. Even before Christ, the Logos, the Word, remember the Word was in the beginning, the Word was with God, the Word was God, the Logos, has always been recognizable in the universe. Before Jesus was born as a recognizable baby, human baby, the Son of God, fully man, fully God. Before that even, John says he was recognizable. He was in the world. How so? Well, we're going to talk about that. The Westminster Confession, that great catechism to teach theology that was written in Great Britain in the 16th century, starts out. It has like 176 different catechisms. And the very first one starts out this way. The goodness, wisdom and power of God is manifest in the lights of nature, in the works of creation, and in providence, so as to leave men inexcusable. It's there. It's there. It's evidence. And it leaves us as human beings without excuse for not knowing and surrendering to God. Paul talked about that in Romans chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. He said, when God created man, every human being, every man, every woman, every boy, every girl has evidence of a real personal God implanted in their being. Evidence of God is there. And then he goes on to say, furthermore, because of that evidence, all man needs to do is to look externally and see the works of God in creation. And it would leave that human being, that man, woman, boy, girl, without excuse when they stand before God on judgment day. Even if they never hear the name Jesus Christ, they are without excuse. And so is man, and I'm using man in the generic sense, as man observes creation, observes the universe, what must he conclude? Three things. First, where there is order, there must be a mastermind. If you find order, it implies someone put that in order. Where there's order, There's got to be a mastermind. Now think about this. The planets keep their course. They always do. Always have, always will. And we depend on that for our very lives. The planets keep their course. The tides roll. I'm not talking about Alabama for you sports fan. They didn't roll too well this year. The tides roll always. The seasons change. You know, take heart. Winter will turn into spring. It's kind of happening right now. I walked out on our front porch yesterday, and I kept smelling honeysuckle. It's like, did Linda take the air freshener out here and want to make the outside smell better? And I noticed that throughout the day. And finally, last night, I went out, and I noticed it. And I noticed this potted plant that we have on the front porch is blossoming. It's in full blossom because it's out of the elements. And, you know, it thinks it's spring already. And there's honey, and it smells so good. You know, it's a little premature. I think it peaked early. I'm worried about that. But the seasons change like clockwork. The sun sets, and it rises, sometimes too early. But it rises, right? Did it rise today? Did it do it yet? Will it do it tomorrow? Of course, like clockwork, implying a clockmaker. If it works like a clock, there was a clockmaker. Clearly, the natural order demands a divine mind behind it, bigger than, greater than man, a greater than man's ability to create that, greater than chance. Because it produces results that chance and a mind, human beings, cannot produce. It requires a divine mind. Someone has said that no astronomer can really be an atheist. No astronomer can really be an atheist because when you look upward and you look outward, there you see God. In reality, when you look at the universe, the stars and the systems, the order, there is God. There is evidence for God, a mastermind. Second, where there is a reasoning mind, there must be supreme reason. Where there's a reasoning mind in the human being, there must be supreme reason. When we look inward, we have to ask, where did we get the power to think? And from the ability to think to the ability to reason what we think, to bring reason to it. And the ability to know. Where did we get that? Where did it come from? Where does morality come from? If there's no God, if this is left up to something else, where did the moral code, this universal, come from? Why do even the most evil people on earth still know in their heart of hearts right from wrong? Where did that come from? Where do we get remorse? Where do we get a sense of guilt? You know, why do you feel guilty because you ate a snack too late last night? Where did that come from? Wasn't just your mother. You know, there's something in us. Where did it come from? The great German philosopher Immanuel Kant said that there were two things that convinced him of God's existence. Two things that proved God to him. One was the starry host above, order in the universe, and the other was the moral code, the moral law within. He said, there's got to be a God. You see, no man can explain himself apart from God. There's no explanation for you apart from God. The moral law within demands a moral lawgiver above. So, what do we see? When we look outward, we see order implies an orderly being, a divine mind, a mastermind. When we look within and we understand that there's reason in the moral code, we understand that there must be supreme reason. And third, where there is a pattern in history, there must be a God of history. And there is a pattern in history. Historian James Anthony Froude said that all of history is just one big demonstration of God's moral law, either obeyed or ignored. There's a pattern that is unexplainable otherwise. George Bernard Shaw said that no nation has ever outlived the loss of its gods. No nation, no culture, no civilization can outlive its moral foundation, its divine code. History, human history proves that moral degeneration, when men forget God, when people ignore God, when they avoid his right to rule in their lives, when men forget God, moral degeneration and national collapse go hand in hand. It's proven in history. the great civilizations, the Egyptian, the Greek, the Roman. And friends, when you look at America, the greatest culture so far in the history of humanity, and the drift from the moral code, the drift into relativism and all kinds of selfishness and the evil that we see, I have real concerns about where we're heading. No nation has survived that because God has made it that way. So the human record, good and bad, is proof that history is really his story. That there's a sovereign God who must rule history, or there will be no history in the future to write. If we don't get that right, that's where we're headed. There's a sovereign God, history shows this, who must rule history, and if he doesn't, there will be no history to write about in the future. So, to sum all that up, before Jesus arrived bodily, before he was born as Jesus, it was still possible to see God in the orderliness of creation, in man's capacity to reason, and in the pattern of history. But in verse 10, now let's move on. I won't take this long with the rest of them. In verse 10, it goes on to say that though the world was created by him and therefore should have recognized him, yet the world did not recognize him. He created it. He implanted evidence in it. And yet the world did not or would not recognize him. So in verse 11, the Creator redoubled his efforts. He doubled down. It says he came to his own. He came to his own. And his own did not receive him. Jesus came to his own. The Greek word there is idia. Idia, his home. But even his own, it's the same word again. This time it's in a different form. It's the Greek idioi. He came to his own people. He came to his own home and then to his own people. And even his own people, the Jews, did not or would not recognize him. And we get that. We see that in human families sometimes, don't we? You know, the parents plan and they envision and they scrimp and they save in order to provide the opportunity of a lifetime for a child, only to have that child grow up and kind of grow away or grow distant and refuse to recognize or refuse to grasp that opportunity. And so they go their own way. You know, you've seen that. You've heard of that. We've witnessed that. Parents work to turn over the family business. The parents work to provide an amazing college education at a premium college that will write that child's ticket to success and significance. And the child grows up and says, not my deal. I want to do my own thing. That's what happened to God. That's exactly what happened to God. And that's why in Luke chapter 19, verse 42, one of the most moving verses in the New Testament, in the Gospels to me, the saddest, as Jesus is coming into Jerusalem and for the final time, in his final days, he knows he's going to go to the cross. He knows he's going to die for the sins of the world. And as he goes, as he nears Jerusalem, he weeps. He begins to weep and he says, oh, eternal peace was within your reach, Jerusalem, but you turned it down. It was within your grasp, but you turned it down, and now it's too late. How sad. I mean, that is the bad news. That's the bad news. And it's really sad. It really is when you think about it. But then we get to the good news. Verse 12. This is the good news. This is the good news of the gospel. But to all who did receive him, he gave them the right to become the children of God, or to be the children of God. For those who welcomed him, Jesus authorized adoption into God's family. Now, of course, every human being is a child of God. People say, well, you know, you don't have to be a Christian to be God's child. You know, we're all children of God, and that's true in a sense. But not every child enters into sonship. Not everyone enters into what we call sonship. We see that as well in human families. Have you seen that there will be sometimes one child who just for whatever reason, they just move in to the parents, so they draw closer to the mom, they grow closer to the father, while another child kind of moves out, becomes more distant as time goes by. Biologically, their family, relationally, not so much. And with God, there is no sonship without fellowship. You cannot have communion, the intimacy that we're talking about in this journey, you cannot have communion without union. And so for people who say, well, you don't have to be a Christian to be a child of God, well, yeah, in a sense, true, but you're not going to have communion. You're not going to have relationship. You're not going to have intimacy. But for those who do, there is intimacy. Now, verse 13 is very clear that this only comes by way of Jesus. If you want to pursue relationship and intimacy with God through Jesus, it only comes through Jesus. It says, verse 13, they are born not of blood or of the will of the flesh or of the will of man, but of God. It's God's doing. You see, a baby can't push its way into a family. The mother might do a little pushing in the process, right, to have the baby, but a baby doesn't push its way into a family. It hasn't happened yet. They can be born into the family, they can be adopted into the family, but it has to do with the will of the parents, the will of the mother and the will of the father. And so it is with God. You know, we don't get the choice of coming to God on our terms. It is, he says, through the will of God. And the will of God implies the way of God. And that's why Jesus said in John chapter 14, verse 6, he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I'm the way. I'm the only way, Jesus is saying, into sonship. Yeah, you have childhoodship, but you don't have sonship unless you go through me. And that only happens, as verse 12 says, right in the middle of what I read already, that only happens for those who believe in his name. To believe in his name simply means to put trust in who he said he was and to trust in what he said he would do. To believe in who he said he was, which is chapter 1, and to put trust in what he said he would do, which is fleshed out in chapters 2 through 21 of John. That's what believing, that's what saving belief is all about. And in verse 14, who he said he was is the embodiment of the glory, grace, and truth of Father God. Who is Jesus? He's the embodiment of the glory, grace, and truth of Father God. Now, again, that's why John is insistent here in chapter 1 that the Greeks, the Ephesian Greeks, and by extension, you and me, really get who Jesus is and grasp what Jesus did. And that's why I'm taking my time here in chapter 1, because we really need to get this. If you're frustrated by the pace, if you're thinking this is a little bit pedantic and academic, I'm doing what John did. I'm making sure we grasp, we really get who Jesus is, and we grasp what he did. Now listen to this. The most important thing I can say to you today is this. It's on the screens. Write it down. Unless we see in Jesus what God is like, we could never dare to think of ourselves as worthy and capable of fully entering into sonship. You can't do it. You can't enter into intimacy, into vital fellowship with God, unless you see what God has done to make that possible through Jesus Christ. That's why we need to saturate, to soak in who Jesus is and in what he did. Now, understand that this may not be so radical to you if you've been in the church for a while, but remember, this was a radically new concept to the Greek world that John was writing to initially. And I think it's now a radical idea in our culture. We are now in a post-Christian, post-modern society. People don't have the foundation of the moral belief system that we once had. And so to know that there is a personal, loving God revealed through Jesus who also demands the right of rulership in our lives, it's kind of foreign. It's a foreign concept. And it was in John's day as well. Augustine, who was a brilliant thinker, probably one of the most brilliant people who's ever lived in the 4th century, was a pagan before he converted to Christianity, and he said that he had studied all the great philosophers, all of the pagan philosophers. He knew all of the philosophical systems. He had read and read and read. He knew them, and he said he had never once, never ever once heard of a God who would reveal himself, who would make himself knowable by becoming a man. That was a foreign concept in the ancient world. John says in verse 14, I love this reading from the Message translation. It says it this way. It says, God, as the Word, became flesh and blood. He did exactly that. He became flesh and blood. And listen, and he moved into our neighborhood. I love that loose translation of it. He took on flesh. He took on humanity. He became God with skin on. And he moved into your neighborhood. And John says, I've seen it with my own eyes. The word that's used there in the Greek text isn't just a spiritual seeing or a spiritual knowing or a revelation of some sort. John is saying, and that happened for John, but he's saying, I literally saw this take place. I saw God become flesh and move in and take up residence among us. I've seen it. And what did he see? What did he see in Jesus of God? He saw glory, grace, and truth. It says he was full of grace and truth, the glory of the Father's only Son. So in Jesus, John says we see that God is grace. God is grace. Grace is the idea that salvation is something that we never deserve, nor could we ever earn. It comes only as a sheer gift of God's pure love. Only by an act of pure divine love do we receive salvation. That's grace. Grace also conveys the idea of beauty and charm. We still use the word that way today, beauty and charm. And in Jesus, John is saying, we see the sheer loveliness of God. You see Jesus, you see the sheer loveliness of God. Without Jesus, the God of judgment awaits us. That's why people think of God instinctively. They think of God as judging. That's why they think of Christianity as you're judgmental. Without Jesus, if you don't know Jesus and you don't know God through Jesus, you're going to think that there is a God whose judgment awaits. But in Jesus, you see that the God of grace adopts us. Judgment awaits. Without Jesus, the God of grace awaits to adopt us. We see grace. In Jesus, we also see that God is truth. God is truth. To see ultimate truth, which we so desperately need in our culture today, don't we? There is an absence of truth because we've made truth relative. In the last however many years, 50 years, we've said that truth for you may not be truth for me. Define your own truth. As long as you don't hurt anybody, truth is whatever you think it to be. So don't try to impose your truth on somebody else. Well, that has led to all kinds of bad stuff in our culture today. And that's why you feel like you're lied to every time a politician is speaking. Right? You know, when you hear a politician in front of a microphone, or I'm just going to stop there. Whenever you hear somebody, you know, that's a leader, you're thinking, they're lying to me. How can I depend that I'm getting the truth? They'll say anything to keep their jobs, to keep their position. There's a dearth of truth. But to see ultimate truth, that unchanging propositional truth, we have to look at Jesus, who perfectly embodied truth. John 14:7, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. He is truth. To hear authoritative truth, to experience it, to find it, authoritative truth, which we need for our lives, we have to listen to Jesus, who unflinchingly spoke it. Even his enemy said, we know that you speak the truth without pulling your punches. That's what the verse references there. He spoke unflinchingly the truth. And to experience liberating truth, truth that sets us free, we have to embrace Jesus, who said, in me you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. If you want to live in freedom, which everybody does, through freedom, you have to come through Jesus to get it. And in Jesus, we see that God is glory. John says when you see Jesus, you see the glory of God. Glory. The Old Testament calls it Shekinah. You know, it's maybe a foreign concept, that one, to some of you, but if you've been in the church for a while, you heard of the Shekinah? Anyone familiar? Let me see. Shekinah? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Shekinah. Often old-timers will say the Shekinah glory. Well, it's kind of redundant because Shekinah is glory. It's like you're saying glory, glory, but that's beside the point. But Shekinah just simply means glory. It means that which dwells. It really came to mean God is dwelling, or God's presence among men, among people. The presence of God among people. It's the literal, visible presence of God among men. When John says we've seen, we've beheld, we've held on to his glory, he's saying in Jesus we've held on to the literal, visible presence of Almighty God. So let me sum this up. When Jesus came, we finally and fully were able to see God's glory, his visible presence. Without Jesus, you couldn't look on God's glory. In Jesus, you can. In Jesus, we finally can grasp God's truth, not relative truth, human truth, but God's truth, his liberating, guiding wisdom for life. And in Jesus, we finally and fully experience God's grace, his unmerited, unlimited favor. And then, John says in verses 16 through 18, and we're going to wrap up with this, he says this, "Indeed, we have all received grace after grace." Some of your translations may say grace upon grace. "From his fullness. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The one and only Son, the one who is at the Father's side, he has revealed him." So let me just summarize what John's saying here. Going back to and wrapping in, beginning in verse 10 all the way into this statement, John is saying that the people had utterly failed, because of sin, had utterly failed to see the God who had showed up through natural revelation. They had utterly failed to see him, couldn't see him, wouldn't see him. They only sensed him as the demanding, punishing lawgiver that Moses received, that Moses revealed, the Mosaic Law. So in the Old Testament, we have this God that people misinterpreted as the God of judgment, and that's why people even today, apart from Jesus, see God as this authoritative being that's ready to wipe us out at one mistake. You know, as the old-timer said, he's the God who will dangle us over the fires of hell on a rotten stick. A lot of people think of God that way. And then John says Jesus came from God. He was with God from the beginning. He was God, showing us what God was like. And through Jesus, we receive, here's what John is saying, we receive wave after wave after wave of grace. Wave after wave after wave of God's unmerited, unlimited favor and love. Grace after grace. That's John's way, simply, of expressing the limitless of Jesus, from whose fullness we get the sum total of all that God is. Isn't that beautiful? In Jesus, we get access. We get baptized in the sum total of all that God is. Let me explain it this way. Have you ever traveled? Maybe you're in a car. Maybe you're on a bike. Some of you are bikers. Maybe you're backpacking. And you're seeing some of the most breathtaking, stunning scenery in all of creation. It takes your breath away. And you think, I've seen it all. There can't be anything greater than this. And then you go around a corner and there's something even more stunning and breathtaking. You ever had that experience? And like every curve, every corner, every turn that you make, you're going, oh my goodness, this is amazing. Yeah? That's what Jesus does. That's what it's like with God through Jesus. Wave after wave after wave of God's sheer loveliness and his unmerited, undeserved love, unearnable love. In Jesus, the unknowable, invisible, unreachable God, that's what people thought of God. In Jesus, this unknowable, invisible, unreachable God came to us, so he will never have to be a stranger to us again. In Jesus, we never again have to tremble in fear before a vindictive, angry tyrant, as people thought of him. But we get a gracious Father in whom we are immersed in the wonder of sonship. We don't have to fear. We get to be baptized
in this relationship. And again, this is the keynote that is sounded here in the first chapter and throughout the Gospel of John. If you want to see what God is like, and you need to, if you're going to move into God, if you want to see what God is like, just look at Jesus. If you want to see what God is like, just look at Jesus. He has made himself noble. He moved into our neighborhood in Jesus. There's a story told, the old story told of a king who was a good king, a wise king, and he ruled over Persia. And this king loved his people. He was concerned. He wanted to know what they were experiencing. He wanted to understand their lives. He wanted to know what they feared, what they were frustrated with, what hindered them from moving into the abundance and the favor that he wanted for them in his kingdom. And so he would disguise himself, and he would go out among his people, and he would especially want to visit with the poor. And he did that. He would often disguise, go out in disguise and visit the poor. And they would never know who he was. They didn't recognize him as the king. He was in disguise. Well, one time he came upon a poor man, and he followed him home. And this man lived in a cellar, a dark, dank cellar. And he went into this man's, poor man's home, and he had a meal with him, a very Spartan, humble meal, coarse food, not very tasty. And through that meal, he encouraged him. He was kind to him. He lifted him up, spoke lovingly to him, and then he went on his way. Well, later he came back and he visited this poor man because he felt like he needed to reveal who he was to this cellar dweller. And he did. He said, "I'm your king. Don't you recognize me?" And he was expecting the man would now ask him for a gift or a favor or some blessing. And this poor man said this to the king. He said, "You've left your palace and your glory to visit me in this awful place. You ate my coarse food. You brought gladness to my heart. What more could I ask for? To others, you gave your riches, but to me, you have given the best gift of all. You have given yourself." You've given yourself. That's what God did for us. He went to the ultimate extreme to reveal his riches in a personal way to us by becoming one of us. He went to extremes. And today, he will go to extremes again to accommodate your need. He's ready to reveal his riches to you again today. Grace after grace after grace. Wave after wave after wave. Unending waves of grace. So what do you need? What do you need? Do you need wisdom? Guidance? Direction? Do you need provision for your life? Financial provision? Do you need healing for your body? Do you need forgiveness? Do you need to know this God who's made himself noble? Do you need to move from childhood into sonship with God through salvation in Jesus Christ? What do you need this morning from him? Or do you just need a big old dose of his joy in your life? What do you need from him? Listen, he has moved into your neighborhood, and he hasn't moved out.
Thanks again for listening to this week's edition of the Portland Christian Center podcast. If you want more information about the ministries of Portland Christian Center or have a prayer need, please visit us online at pcctoday.com. Thanks for listening.